Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Hello, primates! You found Primus Tracks. Congratulations! We're at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter. There's a wonderful Facebook page called Primus Tracks, and you can email us primustrackspod@gmail.com. I am Josh, joined by the erstwhile leader of Mexico City's Primus Tracks Towers, Frankie.
Hi, Josh. Hello, everyone. How's Team Envelope Filter.
Oh, jeez. Gosh darn it. How's the
right
view
off
up there?
Right off the gate.
Yeah, so I'm already sad. How's the view from Primus Tracks Towers today, Frankie?
It's looking fantastic. Particularly looking forward to speaking about this track.
Ah, yes. Today's track, Coattails of a Dead Man, the final asterisk track from Antipop. We'll get into the asterisk in a bit, but I think most of you know what it is. So we're going to talk about this one. It's the asterisk album closer. We always take care of some business before we talk about the track. First things first, you can join the hallowed halls, I suppose, of the Punch Bowl. I never think of a Punch Bowl as having halls, so I'm not sure why I'm using that imagery, Frankie. But you can join the Punch Bowl and dive right in. That one's better. By leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. You can also send us a 5-star review, DM it to us on Instagram. I know that not everybody uses Apple products, myself included. I'm going to share with you a 5-star review that came to us courtesy of Instagram. Frankie, from Brad from New York, who says, "Absolutely love the podcast. I listen every week. It's a refreshing break from all this moron TV. Never thought a couple of dumb shits playing some instruments could have changed my life the way these bastards have. After seeing Les live the first time, I was inspired to pick up a bass. Is it luck? Can't wait to see what's ahead on the Electric Grapevine. Thanks for the hours of entertainment. Primus sucks." Thank you, Brad.
Wow, that was jam-packed with references.
Those are my favorite, because they can catch you off guard when you're reading them the first time through.
Yeah.
So Brad knows the score. He knows how to get our attention. Thank you, Brad. Get those 5-star reviews in. We love reading them, especially because they, you know, make us feel good about ourselves. We also received a lovely email, Frankie, from Haggai in London by way of Israel, who also kindly sent a donation via PayPal to primustrackspod@gmail.com. So
that email was incredible.
It was. I can't read it on the air. It was so long, and the author even said, nope, couldn't keep it short. So thank you so much, Haggai, for your generous donation and the kind words that you had to say. Plus, what I really like is when everybody is sharing their Primus and Les Claypool experiences, Frankie, because I now know a person who attended that Les Claypool show in Israel.
Yeah, that is really amazing. And, you know, I was particularly moved by the part where he said, you know, that he's seen Primus over 10 times and he has managed to meet the band on numerous occasions. And he said, "There's a little Frankie inside every one of us." That was a really nice touch.
It was. A little Frankie inside of us. All screaming to get out. They're being held prisoner. Yeah. They would like to reunite and form Super Frankie, who will definitely rule the music industry any day now. I really enjoyed that myself. I really enjoy that this person has seen Primus and Les Claypool on 3 different continents at least. That's pretty darn impressive.
That's quite a claim.
If you would like to join Captain Shiner's yacht and take a nice ride with the captain himself, you can send some funds to primustrackspod@gmail.com. We'll happily accept. And you, too, will join this legendary crew. And if, you know, we see you at a Primus show, we'll give you a big hug. Okay, I'll give you a big hug. Frankie, I'm not sure. Are you a hugger, Frankie? Do you hug people?
Sometimes.
Okay. I pretty much do it to make people uncomfortable, so it's going to be a big hug. Be ready.
I think we hugged when we met for the New Year's Eve, didn't we?
You're not supposed to tell people that, Frankie. What we do on the streets of San Francisco is our business. I think so, though. I think you're right. I don't have any miscellaneous debris this week. Do you, Frankie?
No, we can kickstart this track.
Good. I wasn't going to mention all the people that were hashtagging Team Envelope Filter. Moving on.
Thank you, guys.
You SOBs. You little scallywags. Let's talk about today's track. Oh my, Coattails of a Dead Man, track 13 from Antipop. It checks in a little over 5 minutes, asterisk. I'm going to be doing that a lot today, I think. We're going to get into it, and I'm so happy, Frankie, that I get to say this one has, albeit unbelievably to some, a live history.
It does, and it's quite interesting, Josh. It was performed 4 times by the Fancy Band on consecutive nights, and it was performed 4 times by Primus as well. So that's a perfect 8, all right? 4 with Fancy, 4 with Primus. This song was only played with J Lane, so it was 4 occasions in 2010.
So we have Fancy Band performances in 2008.
That's right, and yeah. 2 years later, it was resurrected during the return of Primus in 2010.
That's right.
You can tell, I mean, I'm going to jump ahead a little, but it's relevant for the live history. You can tell for a long period of time, this was the only track from Antipop that Les cared for, because it's the only song that was included in the Zingers compilation, even though it was not a single at all.
Right.
And it's also, you know, the only Antipop song that was resurrected for a very long time.
Yeah, they brought that right out in 2010. You know, it also got a little bit of play, as in one little time. It was teased one time in '04 on one of those reunion tours. And we'll
play that
for you later. It's pretty interesting. So it was in his mind for a while, and then Fancy Band played it, and then Primus got to play it. And I'm happy to say I am one of very few people who has seen Primus perform this in its entirety. So one of those,
what was it like to witness that song live?
You know, I was going to say, that performance, when I realized what they were doing, I actually freaked out a little bit in a good way, because I knew that they, up to that point, they'd only played it once. So I think I got the second Primus performance of it. So I was really excited, and I whipped out. Now, this is 2010, so I whipped out my digital camera. Digital camera's 2010, not great. I was really close to one of the sound stacks, so the audio is way blown out. It sounds terrible, but I do have video evidence of this track being played somewhere on an SD card.
Yeah, amazing.
And they didn't overdo it. They just kind of played it through, did the chorus a couple times, and were done. So it was a little bit shorter, I think, than the album version. And of course, it's just the three of them doing their parts. But I really enjoyed it and got to sing along a bit, and I had a good time.
I thought you would, you know, take out one of those phones that flipped open.
And take a 0.3 megapixel video or picture, absolutely. But I do get to say something I haven't said in a long time. So for a performance of Coattails of a Dead Man, I was there.
It's been a while since you said that.
Wow, that felt good. I hope we get to more tracks where I get to say that. And you're absolutely right. This one appeared on the Zingers compilation. It felt to me like on the Little League team anymore, when everybody gets a trophy, they had to pick one from Antipop. So Les picked Coattails, probably the least compromised track on the album.
Yeah, but I mean, he cheated.
He cheated.
It was not a single.
Oh.
It didn't have a music video. So you would think that those would be the two requirements for a song to be in that compilation.
I think there are plenty of tracks on that compilation that didn't get that treatment, but they're definitely live staples. So,
there's Grapevine, for example, but it's accompanied, you know, by Wynonna and South Bend Pachyderm. So there is a little bit of context. But in this case, it's like he barely acknowledged the existence of that album.
Right.
Just because he have to, and he chose, I don't know, could be his favorite track on the album, or the one he hated the least. Who knows?
Let's go with hated the least.
Okay.
Sounds great. Well, let's hear what he had to say, actually, in 1999 from Bass Player Magazine. Thank you once again, Mr. Perez. These are Les's words. He said, "I knew this would be magic. Originally, it was a Woody Guthrie-like acoustic guitar thing, but Tom Waits heard it and said stuff like, in gravelly voice, Let's make it sound like it's going through the meat grinder. Seeing Tom hunched over the Mellotron playing that crazy part with his weird, almost double-jointed hands was one of the most incredible things I've ever witnessed. Brain was banging on this old wagon wheel hoop and big marching bass drum Tom brought over. I played my Dan Maloney electric upright, just plucking the downbeats. It's the only song where all the basic tracks were one take, including my vocals. When we were done, I said to Tom, let me know if there's anything else that needs to go on the song. He called me a couple days later and said it needed some glockenspiel. So we added that, which was the perfect final touch.
Brilliant.
The idea that it started as a Woody Guthrie-like song is fascinating to me. I would love to see where they would have taken it with that. But, as mentioned, we do get Tom Waits on this track. So, Coattails of a Dead Man, we have Les, Larry, and Brain doing their normal things. Bass, guitar, drums, Les on vocals. Tom Waits shows up with the Mellotron, and a couple days later, a glockenspiel. Which, by the way, they rented from People's Music of Sebastopol. It's there in the album liner notes. Tom's also on vocals, and
Martina is there, too.
Martina is there, too. As we discussed on Drowning Man, I think, she decided to hang around for a couple extra days when Tom Waits was going to show up. And this is something I'd forgot, Frankie. This track is credited as produced by Tom Waits. He was pushing...
And you can tell immediately.
He was pushing the buttons. So when it was his turn, he said, put it through the meat grinder. And that really... one can tell. And before we even talk about the track too much, Frankie, itself and its merits, don't you think just the Brown album being Tom Waits' favorite and this track having the sound that it does, don't you think this one should... I really think this one should have gotten the Brown album treatment.
It certainly has, you know, that same quality of tragic characters from the Brown album, such as Arnie or Resting Bones. So, yeah, I can either see the track receiving that kind of production or the track itself fitting on the Brown album. What I also want to point out is that it's, you know, obviously with repeated listenings, it's not the case, but at least the first time that you hear the record from beginning to end, it's a really pleasant surprise to realize that the intro is just a fragment from this song. So Les effectively carried on the tradition of bookmarking the albums with something that goes back to the beginning.
Oh, right. Yes, absolutely. Because we get the greatest track of all time intro, which is the snippet from the intro of this track. You're absolutely right. So he did bring it back around that way, which is great. It's a little circular thing. Speaking of that intro, I do want to play it because Tom's playing a Mellotron, and I don't think a lot of people know what that is. If you do a search for Mellotron demo on YouTube, you'll find plenty of them. But the Mellotron's fascinating to me because you hear it a lot, Frankie, when it's played straightforward. Not like you hear Tom Waits play it, of course, because only Tom Waits can do what he does. But when you hear this sampling from a Mellotron, Frankie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's a flute sample that was programmed into a Mellotron. When you hear that, I just immediately think of 70s UK psychedelic music and that sort of thing, which makes sense, actually, because the Mellotron was developed in the mid-60s in the UK. And for those of you that haven't seen it, it does have piano-like keys, but under the hood, those keys, when you strike them, they actually hit tapes on rollers. And so it's like a sampler of sorts because you get the sound at that pitch from whatever instrument was sampled. So in that little tidbit, you heard flute, you can do it with organ, you can do it with voice, whatever. But it also has dials to where you can change the samples around from flute, violin, what have you. And then there are knobs to change the speed of the tape roller as well as the tone. So you can manipulate these sounds in a lot of different ways. So as Les described, Tom is hunched over that thing with his big old goofy hands playing this and manipulating some dials. So instead of happy sounding flutes, you get this. And that's about the Tom Waits filter right there. Defined. Love it.
One, two, three.
Oh, yeah. So I remember when I first heard this track, Frankie, as soon as that first bass drum hit, I knew I was in for something great. Because it was just Primus actually playing very simplistic music and Tom Waits just going ape and doing Tom Waits things. But Primus has this thing that they do where they can play something incredibly complex and it's very engaging and fun to listen to and irritating for people who are don't really understand it. Or they can play things that are really super simple and let the lyrics carry the day. So when you hear just the Primus instrumentation, and I'll play a few more seconds, it's very simplistic, but they're letting Tom Waits really steal the show here. So we get, we're getting that 6-8, 12-8, I'll call it 12-8 waltz thing going on. Pretty simplistic bass line from Les. He's just hitting the downbeats like he said. Larry's just hitting his clean guitar there. Brain's basically got four things. He's got the big marching bass drum, the hoop, a snare. He's got something he's hitting like a cymbal, but it's kind of buried in the mix, so I'm not entirely sure what it is. Being that Tom Waits was there, I'm going to guess it was a old frying pan. I'm not entirely sure. But what are your general impressions of this one musically, Frankie, knowing that Tom Waits is making these devilish noises on Glockenspiel and Mellotron?
It stands completely apart from the rest of the songs on the album.
Yeah.
At least for me, you know, it could fit in the Brown album. Mm-hmm. It is out of place sonically in Antipop, but, you know, that is not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It's quite an interesting way to end the record.
Yeah.
Asterisk. But, yeah, I mean, since the first time, you know, I heard the full album, the track stood out, not because of the lyrics, which I did not really research at that moment.
Yeah,
it took me a while, you know, to dive into them and realize what they were about. But just at the beginning, it was the music that was completely different to the rest of the songs. So not only does it have, you know, this intervention from Tom Waits, which is pretty unique, you know, it also has things that they of course would not have done had they been on their own. So who knows what the song would have sounded like if it had been done only by the band with, you know, with no external input or influences. But as a whole, you know, I think regardless of it being a Primus song, just as a musical piece itself, I think it's something very well crafted, mm-hmm. really well executed and accomplished. I think it's a really, really interesting piece of music.
What happens to some people is they're thrown off by a guy like Tom Waits. People don't realize that he is an accomplished and talented and really good songwriter. The guy can write songs like nobody's business. He's got 1,000 albums and he's got songs just laying around. But he knows how to arrange, he knows how to put tunes together that, you know, to the average person are probably annoying or strange. But to a guy like me, I'm very engaged by what he's doing because it's so out of the norm. So I think he did a phenomenal job producing this track. Now, as we said, the Primus guys keep it simple, and you raised a good point. If it was just the three of them, as we'll hear on some of the live cuts, it's pretty simple and it doesn't really go anywhere. But that's where they, I think, were purposefully saving lots and lots of space for Tom Waits to do his thing with the Mellotron and then call a couple days later and say, hey, it needs a Glockenspiel. But I also want to point out just vocally, when you listen to Martina Topley-Bird, she was wise to stick around because she adds some really nice dynamics to this one. She really compliments, and I'm going to guess that Les's faux operatic singing of a sort, that's what I'm going to call it, was pushed by Tom. And so Les is doing these, she cried in the night, you know, he's doing that sort of thing,
yeah.
Which he doesn't normally do, but we've talked about how he's taking steps forwards as an actual singer. And this track is no exception, especially these last two tracks, yeah, that we've talked about. So his faux operatics, Tom's doing what Tom does, his growling raspiness. But he's also kind of, which I really love. But she's doing this humming that's kind of atonal in spots, tonal in others, and singing throughout. And if you listen to the track just for her voice, it's kind of rewarding because it weaves in and out. Of course, she's singing in a different register than the men are, so you can hear it. But if you're listening closely to it, you can hear what she's doing all throughout the track. She's almost constant in her presence, and I really appreciate it, adding that dynamic to it.
In the case of Martina, I think, you know, she's a very welcome addition in this album. Albeit briefly, because she only appears on two songs, but it is, you know, prior to the Fancy Band, for example, where you have Gabby, or Bucket of Burning Brains, where you also have Gabby. I mean, prior to that, a female contribution in a Primus song was unheard of, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it's a breath of fresh air to have that in the song.
Yeah.
Regarding Tom Waits, I'm going to be very honest. I think what he's doing works pretty well for the song. Mm-hmm. In general, you know, I admire his originality. I think he's a great songwriter. I think he has a very interesting career. But I think he's even more of an acquired taste than Primus or Les could ever be.
Oh, sure, I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that it's like a one-off, you know, it's just one song on the album, similar to Tommy the Cat on Seas of Cheese. So, you know, it's got a novelty factor that makes it enjoyable. But I cannot picture myself enjoying more of his vocals throughout the album. And in the case of Les, well, I agree with you. He's doing very histrionic things with his voice, which I think is a result of that newfound confidence that he had around this album, perhaps thanks partially to Stuart Copeland, right?
Stu, Tom, whoever's pushing him, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So right. I'm guessing that for this song, you know, he was testing what he could do with his voice as a singer, as opposed to approaching the song as a narrator the way that he had been doing for a long time.
Yeah, he's definitely pushing into new territory for himself. I also want to add, a good friend of mine once told me he's a big Tom Waits fan, but he once told me, my wife doesn't let me listen to Tom Waits when we drive because it makes her too nervous. I guess it's too much for her senses when they're on a road trip. So I can see it being, you know, I like, it is kind of funny that Primus is like entry level weird for me. It's like, yeah, they're just weird enough and catchy enough that this is like my pop music. And then go further down the rabbit hole with guys like Tom, Beefheart, and then
Beefheart. I mean, that's Beefheart, Zappa. Yeah, it's like a complete different level. Have you ever heard the Tiger Lilies?
I have not, actually.
I love two songs from them, but it's the same case, you know. I cannot picture myself listening to a full album or listening to them daily. Yeah. And for me, Tom Waits falls in that same category.
Okay. So you can appreciate him in limited doses.
Yeah, of course. For example, I really like the song Guts Away on Business.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Even the music video is really cool. You know, I like that song a lot. I think the lyrics are brilliant. But would I endure, I don't know, 1 hour or 2 hours of Tom Waits? Probably not. in that regard, when people say that Primus is too weird, you know, in my mind, I think there are things 10 times weirder and not in a very enjoyable way. That is also something admirable about Primus, you know, how they have managed to steer clear from the mainstream in the magnitude that other bands have experienced that kind of success, but they are not unlistenable.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So when people say, boy, this is weird, I say, you want to hear weird? I got weird, you know, and then put on Melt Banana or something and they lose their minds or never talk to me again. Whatever. One of the two. So you're absolutely right. But this is kind of like a glimpse into what Primus could be if they really embraced the Tom Waits inside all of them. But also with the goofiness around the Mellotron, how it just doesn't how it just sounds loose like that, the way Tom's manipulating it. It to me has a resonance quality to it too, because the resonance are really, really known for doing that with some of the tonalities in their music, making them shaky like that, or just kind of shifting it a little bit so that you're never on stable ground with them. So
sure.
I hear a little bit of that too. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but speaking of weird, there's a band for you.
I want to ask you something, because I'm sure that you're more familiarized with Tom Waits than I am, but I have the impression that his music became progressively more challenging as time went by, because the other day I was listening to this song called New Coat of Paint from his second album. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's pretty straightforward. It's a pretty enjoyable piece of jazz music.
Right. Yes. If you listen to his first two records, they're pretty straightforward piano-driven tunes, because that's kind of how he got his start. And then, then a little bit later on, he decided to go down the rabbit hole of weirdness and became what he became. I don't know all his info. I do remember reading he was heavily influenced, by Beefheart, but I'm sure there are other influences at play there, as well as his own original thinking. So he's truly one of a kind when it comes to American music, or really any music out there in the world. You know, there's not too many people that sound even close to him. And if you try, it's pretty obvious, I think. I do want to play the chorus where it all comes together at the end, and then when all three vocalists come together to sing the same line on the coattails of a dead man shall ride.
Dead man shall ride, shall ride on the coattails of a dead man.
Pause. I love Tom's throughout the tune. He does that a few times. But that when they hold that note, dead man. Oh, that's great. I'm a big fan of that part when they hold that note all together. And then I think we get Tom. I think this is where Tom says, hit him up, which I really enjoyed too. Les is really going for it.
So
I'm mostly listening to Les there, but it's really great to hear Martina bringing that other element. So actually, I'm mostly listening to Tom go, because it's really fun. So there, when it all comes together there, Frankie, that's of course the highlight of the track for me, with that great chorus at the end. And then the end, Frankie, and you know, it kind of falls apart at the end. Sometimes that's what Primus songs do. But so it seems like they have three categories. One, the tune just kind of falls apart. Two, they actually plan an ending and they have something structured. Or three, and this is the cardinal sin, they fade out.
First thing, yeah.
So at least this one, they just said, oh, we'll just let it fall apart, which I think is apropos for the music and even, I guess, the lyrical content. That's quite an album closer. Or is it?
Or is it?
Asterisk.
Asterisk.
Well, let's talk lyrics, Frankie. This one is chock full of them. And anybody, this is like, we haven't talked about the 90s for a couple of episodes, I think, but if you remember the 90s, you definitely remember this power couple of a sort in the world of pop culture. I am, of course, talking about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, he's never come out and said it. But I think everybody knows who Les is actually referring to with this track as far as the lyrics go. Or at least everybody has made that leap, not much of a leap, taken that little step to apply it to the story of Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. And I want to point out these lyrics are generic enough you could say they're fictional or could apply to almost any
that's
situation
right.
that's related to that, and therefore Les isn't getting sued, which I think is really
that's
important
a,
consideration.
That's a crucial point because, yes, I mean, they fit the situation quite well, and it would, you know, it would seem crystal clear what who he's singing about. But at the same time, sometimes I ponder about mm-hmm. these lyrics, and I tell myself, you know, Les had never been to that point, or afterwards, you know, I don't know if he ever had been so overt or so direct in his critique about specific celebrities, mm-hmm. you know, because, I mean, of course, he can address a particular person directly with no problem, like in the track Junior from
right.
Bucket of Bernie Brains. But in this case, I mean, we're talking about, you know, these famous people from pop culture. Had Les actually been so overtly critical about a specific famous person before?
Not that I can reference, no. And
exactly. So it's quite yeah. out of character, right? So it does make yeah. you wonder if he wanted to just address a generic situation. And then it's up to the listener, you know, to think who could fit that description.
Right. And by doing that, of course, you absolve yourself of all liability, but you're also given that wink, you know. Gee, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say them all, say them all. So, and it comes through in the lines. You know, he wasn't looking for fanfare or fame, but it all came around just the same. Absolutely. Now, I don't know, and I'm not going to sit here and postulate about it. I don't really know anything about the relationship between Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. I don't know anything about their marriage. Never looked it up. And I'll tell you, Frankie, going back to the 90s, especially 93, 94, at my little Catholic school there, I'm thinking me and my friend Graham were the only two people in that school who even knew what Nirvana was. And, you know, he'd put Nirvana on some of those mixtapes that included Primus as well, that he handed over to me that I would listen to endlessly. And I liked the Nirvana songs, but they didn't jump out at me, especially as much as Primus or Megadeth or Helmet, for that matter. I liked them well enough, and I knew some things, but I no idea about the relationship between these two people. So
you would have to venture into Courtney's music, you know, in order to get a bigger picture about the dynamic. For example, there's this song from Hole called Good Son, and it deals with Kurt cross-dressing with Courtney's clothes. Or, of course, you know, one of the greatest examples of the relationship is Doll Parts, which was actually the first time I ever heard Courtney Love's music before. There are some specific verses in the lyrics that bring to my mind particular scenes that I actually saw on the television. For example, the bigger the camera, the bigger the tear. That immediately reminds me of a report that I saw on MTV where Courtney Love was grieving in public, surrounded by fans. And I think there was even a particular point when she was giving away stuff to the fans. She later admitted she regretted doing that. But
yeah,
that comes to my mind immediately when Les sings that part.
Oh, okay. And this was this a public memorial or something? Or a vigil?
I don't recall the specific occasion, but I think it had just, you know, it had just been a few days after the fact, and she was yeah. just hanging outside. I don't know if it was outside the house huh. or where she was, but she was surrounded by this group of people, and they were all crying together.
Okay. And if cameras show up, especially in 94, somebody's telling someone ahead of time, right? Because it's not just somebody whips out their smartphone. That doesn't, you yeah. know, in 94, yeah. it's not happening. Yeah, something's strange there. The bigger, with the bigger the camera, the bigger the tear. I can see that connection now. You know, yeah, he let himself out with two barrels of steel. I mean, you can find the death report and all kinds of photographs, actually.
Yeah, that's so right.
That's that stuff's out there. It's really interesting. When his eyes, they burn from the bright limelight, he found comfort in the bottle of old Jimmy Beam. He doesn't mention the heroin there, so, you know, plausible deniability. But we know the guy was drinking, too. But the bright limelight part is really important because even in the guy's suicide note, which I read before recording this, talk about an upper going into recording. Hey, he does mention it. He had been performing for a long time, and he's performing for these people, but he's not getting enjoyment out of it anymore. He's not getting the charge he used to, and it's just like a job. And so that fame and those expectations, he just can't handle it. And so
that's the impression I've always had, you know, from Nirvana, that had they gone on for a few more years, that band was destined to implode.
That wouldn't surprise me one bit. Drugs will do that to you. Ego will do that to you.
Oh, just a minor correction. The song is actually called Beautiful Son.
Oh, Beautiful Son. Okay, yeah. Good Son. No, that's the Macaulay Culkin movie that everybody...
That's right.
universally loved, The Good Son.
I'm curious, Josh, have you ever explored Courtney Love's music, either solo or with Hole?
I think I discounted it. Given the trajectory, right? Because now we should say that she was pursuing music for quite some time before her relationship with Cobain and kind of getting famous as a result of their marriage and relationship and then his death. So she was already on the upward trajectory herself. But I'm not really familiar with any of the music. But that I did read that. Live Through This. I don't know.
Oh, Live Through This.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. So Live Through This was released, 3 days after Cobain's body was discovered, right? So,
and then she got accused of using Kurt's lyrics for the album, right? Or an accusation of the sort that he had written the songs. And the same thing happened to her with Celebrity Skin. They said Billy Corgan had done a lot of stuff on that album that was not credited.
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, whether that's true or not, I think and I don't know, I couldn't tell you, but just that weird timing that's when that album dropped. And then, of course, it was humongous. That thing went platinum, and I think a couple more of theirs did. So I think at that point, though, I was kind of discounting that because I was going in another direction. I was just crazy for metal. And, I'm sure there were some Hole songs on the radio because I still listened to the radio a little bit at that time. And I don't think it clicked for me at that time. And I never went back to it.
I think because of her reputation, people tend to be sometimes too harsh about her output.
Yeah.
Which, you know, being objective, she has got to be one of the worst live performers ever, right? I mean,
okay.
you can look up any footage online, and she's absolutely awful. Cannot sing on key to save her life. You know, she has really terrible guitar playing skills. But as a studio recording artist, I think she has done some pretty interesting things. Solo, you know, she's very erratic. She released an album in 2004, then vanished completely, and then just dropped two or three songs a few years ago.
Okay.
But with Hole, she had a, you know, kind of steady trajectory until they separated. And she does have some cool songs, I think.
It's probably worth checking out. I don't know that I will, but I think what maybe you were hinting at too is not just for her performances, but she's probably unfairly maligned for benefiting from her husband's death, essentially.
Absolutely.
So that's what the lyrics kind of point to that too, especially that last verse. Most folks agree she was living a hell. Publicly, she showed her pain, and never once was there a thought for herself and the ever-growing slices of fortune and fame. Right. So it's that subtle jab there. That this is how you're getting famous.
I'm very compelling, might I add.
Really well written verse there, yeah. For these anonymous people in this song,
characters,
which we are applying to this situation, which most people are. So, That's gotta be rough, being in that situation. And, you know, how do you navigate that? I always think about press releases or social media posts now where such and such a well-known or treasured or beloved person has died. We thank you for respecting the family's privacy in their time of sadness, right? As opposed to, and things go quiet, right? As opposed to, you know, profiting. That comes later. I think nowadays most people actually just fight over the estate. Then try to get rich. And I don't know, you know, I wasn't there mentally at the time. I was just like, I love thrash metal. Me, 13 years old. But, you know, I know this was a big deal. I mean, this made the world news, for crying out loud. I actually found the Kurt Cobain death report from ABC News, April 8th, 1994. I do want to play a portion of it. And I want to play it because the news reporter says something very interesting that I think we will look back on, given our ages now, and might give us something to think about.
Into a drug and alcohol-induced coma. Days ago, his band dropped out of a major American tour. It was rumored they were breaking up. Today, fans reacted.
When you reach that kind of fame and you're still miserable, there's something wrong.
Many people over 30 probably never heard of Kurt Cobain. That's for younger fans, his music captured the spirit of the difficult transition from youth to maturity.
I agree. You know, I was identifying with that music at the time as I was transitioning from youth to maturity, if that's what you could call it. Most people over 30 don't even know his name. There was a time. Isn't that incredible? Yeah. And now I'm 40 and I'm like, everybody knows who that guy is. But
I mean, everybody and their mother has a Nirvana t-shirt, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I want to come back to the t-shirts in a moment. But that idea that I think nowadays, I'm trying to think of something analogous because music is so fractured now. But if one of the more famous YouTubers out there died tragically at the age of 27, I wouldn't know who they are. Right. So I'm that person now. So when I hear that news report, I go, those squares, well, now I'm the square.
Yeah.
Man.
I agree completely. I don't know how long those guys have been around for, but it was until the last year that I was watching TV and somebody explained, this is BTS, you know, and those guys were on screen.
Oh.
And I thought, okay. Oh, so that's the band that Soya's daughters were listening to.
Funny. Even I know BTS, Frankie. Wow. I thought I was the only one. Speaking of Soya, little known fact for some of you Victims Family fans out there, or maybe you know this, but Victims Family played gigs with Nirvana when they were first coming up, late 80s, early 90s. So
Nirvana also played at Iwana's, where Primus would also play twice.
Ah, yes. Now, speaking of that, and I wanted to mention this earlier, but I don't think that Primus and Nirvana or Les, Lurd, Tim cross paths with those Nirvana guys really at all in the early 90s, even though they were on similar trajectories, even though Nirvana completely blew up. Primus was more of a slow build to a shorter plateau, but they both rode that wave. But I don't think they ever really crossed paths. So we don't have a direct connection as far as I know.
I don't think so. You know, I want to go back a little bit to what you said about how Courtney was navigating the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to point out that, I mean, I wouldn't use the expression, give her credit, but I do want to say that people can be very harsh with public figures or celebrities
right.
in those kind of situations. Because, I mean, it's a really, really awful and complicated situation in and on itself. Now, imagine how magnified it gets when it happens to a public figure and, you know, someone that has a cult following or a lot of fans. It's like you cannot win, right?
Right.
You're going to upset someone no matter what. It kind of reminds me of when Peaches passed away and Bob Geldof wrote a letter about her and it was posted online. And people were saying things like you know, the letter is weird or it doesn't convey a lot of emotion. And I just thought, well, you cannot really judge something like that, right? I mean, in normal circumstances, maybe you would not even write anything at all. So maybe he just had to do it because he's a public figure and he had to address the topic. So of course it could come out a little awkward, right? Mm-hmm.
And you're also at that point you're in shock too, you know.
Exactly.
How can you even function?
Yeah. So you know, it's like when people say, "Why did Courtney give away his stuff?" You know, because she was just looking for attention, or because the cameras were rolling. Well, maybe she was in shock, right? Maybe she had no idea what she was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. We've all had loved ones die. You, me, listeners. Think about that state of mind you were in. It's a strange place to be, and it's surreal, and you're not sure how to feel, what to do. It's a strange thing.
And imagine if a camera, you know, is in front of you, it must be even harder.
Right. So, you know, and I don't, like I said, I'm not familiar with the situation, but it's got to be tough. It doesn't matter who it is. So, you run through these lyrics. Once again, this is not a pointed criticism, and I don't think Les Claypool is trying to hurt anybody's feelings, but, you know, he's telling this story, and this is a story that could be applied probably to a lot of different couples who actually existed, or it could just be a morality tale. I'm glad it's vague enough. We'll say
indeed.
That. Yeah.
I got a tiny bit of trivia for you, Josh.
Lay it on me.
One time, I think they asked David Byrne about one of his most awkward encounters with a pop star, and he said that he was sitting at this bar, and guess who approached him and sat next to him to share a drink?
Joe Bonamassa.
Close. Courtney Love.
Oh, no way. What year was that?
I don't remember the year, but he said that she started talking to him, and, you know, he thought, oh, well, I'll just have a drink with her. But then she put her hand on his thigh, and he excused himself and just vanished from the location.
It's pretty funny. She made David Byrne uncomfortable. That's a claim to fame. Good for her. Speaking of the 90s, man, this is a time capsule of the 90s, this track, when we think, if we apply it to Kirk and Courtney there. But I will say, probably in the mid-90s, Frankie, the most ubiquitous t-shirt out there, and you pointed to it earlier, was that Kurt Cobain memorial t-shirt that had that specific photo of him. And it said Kurt D. Cobain, 19 whatever to 1994 underneath. I will tell you, my freshman year of high school, fall of 95, they were all over that school and continued to be. I mean, it petered out after a while, but I couldn't go a day without seeing that shirt somewhere in public on somebody's body. They were everywhere. Now, you were not alive, so you wouldn't have experienced this, it was a strange thing. Any of our listeners over the age of 30 would be able to corroborate that. With all that said, let's turn back to the Primus side of things. You want to hear some live cuts?
Yeah, bring them on. So we got a tease, right?
We're starting with the tease, the aforementioned tease from Norfolk 2K4. Looks like this was on the Fromage tour. They snuck this little tidbit into Is It Luck?
Tease on.
So he's got it in his head.
Yeah.
So I wonder if he had tossed that out there as, hey, let's play that one, but it never came to fruition. Or he just had the lyrics rattling around. So we got that nice tiny little tease in 2K4. Let's fast forward to 2010, the triumphant return of Primus. This is the Congress Theater in Chicago, Illinois, not too long after I saw them and witnessed this track as well. Let's hear three-piece Primus, Coattails. Ooh, they picked up the tempo.
The time to say we're good. The time to say we're good. Most times it was just good between.
So they're kind of motoring through it because of the simplicity, I think, but it sounds cool.
I already had that impression from the studio recording, but it's even more emphasized by the live cut. I don't know if you have the same impression, but listening to the performance, it strikes me as this song is designed for Les to have fun on stage. You know, It's kind of a storytelling thing, and he's got the upright thing going on. But there's not much action for the other two guys, so they just have to kind of trot along.
Right, yes. And Les gets to have fun with his vocal delivery.
Yeah.
Now, it's been a long time since I listened to any of these, so I'm going to go towards the end because I don't recall if Jay or Larry provide any backup vocals on the chorus at the end. So let's all be surprised or let down. Let's see what happens. Nope. I think we get Larry vamping a little bit on the guitar, but nothing more than that. They could have done like a barbershop thing with the three of them. That'd have been fun.
Well, Lur may or may not have been singing because his microphone level is always way down.
That's true. You can never tell. Yeah. So he was probably whispering into the microphone from 3 feet away and it just didn't pick it up. Darn it. That Lur. So there you go. It's only been, what'd you say, 4 Primus performances? So that's
4
one of them.
4 Primus, 4 Fancy, 8 total. Perfect number.
It's so they shouldn't ruin it by performing it ever again is what I'm taking from that. All right.
Exactly.
Well, I think you'll all be relieved to know that I have a cover. And this cover is quite fascinating, Frankie. This is the Electric Rumpke Mountain Band. And it looks like there's about... it looks like they have some guests on stage, too. So they have about 32 people. This was posted December of 2021. And there's kind of a long intro, but I'm going to play a couple minutes of this because with the little intro that this guy plays, he does segue into the tune, and they actually also deliver the vocals. So check this out. Electric Rumpke Mountain Band. Bluegrassy. Faded out there because they get into some soloing, but I really...
Does it really go on for 8 minutes?
Yeah, they jam it out.
Okay.
It sounds really good. I like that approach, and it even gets a little body sounding there, almost like some Delta stuff, so it's kind of cool, man. I like their approach on this cover.
Interesting cover.
I'm a big fan of that cover, and I was surprised I found one of any sort, so that one's a winner. Well, I only get to ask this one more time, asterisk, Frankie. Coattails of a Dead Man, is it Primus?
Once again, kind of difficult question to answer. Mm-hmm. It is Primus with outside input. Mm-hmm. With elements that you would not normally hear in a straightforward Primus recording. Yeah. Nevertheless, the input is not intrusive enough that it takes away the Primus factor from the equation. So my answer is yes, it is Primus, asterisk.
I've been saying for a lot of these that have the outside influence, I've been saying kind of, and yes, with outside influence. On this one, I think I'm going to say yes, with the distinction that this is Primus with an influence that is more in tune with them than some of the others on this record.
Agreed.
If we were going to go that road, I'd say, yeah, this is way more Primus than a couple of those Tom Morello tracks. It kind of is. But Tom definitely lends, as you said, he lends a lot of influence, and it definitely goes a Tom Waits direction. This would have fit on Mule Variations, the Tom Waits grand return that Primus is actually on on the first track, Big in Japan. So to me, it kind of is. But I really like the results. Coattails of a Dead Man, you should probably go get dry cleaned because you've been tracked. Next time, Frankie, we're going to discuss what might be the greatest Primus track of them all.
It's just a matter of opinion, Josh.
I knew you'd hit that post for me. Everybody, thank you for tuning in at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter. Visit Frankie on the Facebook page, PrimusTracksPod@gmail.com. Keep sending those emails. It's really fun to read. It's been actually quite rewarding through this Antipop record.
Guys, you fuel us to keep going.
Yeah, it's been so great to bond over this silly thing that we have dedicated so much time to. It's great to make those bonds with people and hear people's stories.
We strive on praise.
Oh, yeah, without it, I'm a wreck. So, Frankie's seen me in tears when we have an empty mailbox.
Yes.
Help him by helping me. Later days.
Willie Mays.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.